Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We're having a Dharma talk this morning just to hopefully help further clarify what we're doing here and how we're going to do it and why. Kind of what, how, and why of a retreat. As I was mentioning yesterday, I gave this frame for retreat being the process of entering into a different kind of space, and you could say a different kind of time. And I was referring to this work of Victor Turner talking about entering a liminal space. You could say the liminal space of retreat. And that one of the characteristics of the space is the silence that we offer to one another. And not only that, the importance that this is something that we're doing together, even though there's a quality of aloneness and seclusion, which is really important for this practice. But also that we do it together. And again, I gave you that image of the women's, or the metaphor of the women's knitting circle. These women weaving their lives back together again, which is the quality of Sangha. And I spoke a little bit about what we're doing in this new space, this liminal space. And again, I used yet again a metaphor, which is of this journey, this inner journey, and going towards the heartwood, referring to the Buddha's simile of the heartwood. And the heartwood being the freedom of your heart, the freedom of the mind and the heart. And the vehicle being the willingness to be present. Today I want to speak a little bit more about this vehicle of being present and saying a bit more about it, what the purpose of it is, and also some more details about it. Most of you know that this word vipassana means to see clearly or to see through. And that the reason why we're coming into the present moment is not just to be present, but it's to see things clearly, because the Buddha said that's the what's so important for freedom to arise, is we need to see the nature of this experience clearly in order for the mind to have the skillful relationship to it, or to disentangle from it. As Marcel Proust said, he said, "The real voyage of discovery consists of not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes." That's what this retreat is about, is cultivating these new eyes so that you're relating to and seeing experience differently, so that the mind isn't as entangled in it, so that there isn't this quality of discontent and dissatisfaction and suffering in our lives. And what I'd like to do is to begin with just kind of some descriptions of seeing, what I call seeing clearly, as a way of, again, painting a picture. A lot of times what I'm trying to give to you is some kind of image or metaphor to help get a feeling quality of what the seeing clearly is about, or whatever other topic I'm talking about. And in order to facilitate that, I'd like to share with you some impressions from astronauts that were on some of the early Apollo missions, just because I find it so striking that they were in, again, a different space, a very different space, and there was a kind of seeing clearly that happened, and I think there's some connections we can make between that and what we're doing here. Yeah, so let me share with you some of these. The first description comes from Frank Borman, who was the commander of the Apollo 8 mission. He says, "The view of the Earth from the Moon fascinated me. A small disk 240,000 miles away. It was hard to think that that little thing held so many frustrations. Raging nationalistic interests, famines, wars, pestilence don't show from that distance. If some stranger came from another part of the heavens, he would certainly know instinctively that the destinies of all who lived on it must inevitably be interwoven and joined. We are one hunk of ground, water, air, clouds, floating around in space. From out there, it really is one world. Again, raging nationalistic interests, famines, wars, pestilence don't show from that distance. I find striking. And what did he really see? That it really is one world there. And here's another description. This is from Buzz Aldrin from the Apollo 11 mission. He says, "The soft glowing presence of planet Earth in the black abyss had a pristine clarity uncaptured by photographs. Images on film lacked the subtle shades, the brightness, and the depth of the living sphere, which bulged out of the blackness as I sailed outward on Apollo 11. From the deep blue of the Mediterranean, all of Europe and Africa sprawled away in soft pastels, innocent of political boundaries. And from the surface of the moon, where I could cover with my thumb the site of all human history, the earth seemed fragile as a Christmas ornament, drifting like a lost balloon on the black velvet of space. The image of a living earth capable of extinction disarms illusions of individual or tribal isolation. We gained more than altitude in those 66 years from Kitty Hawk to the moon, seeing Earth not as an extension of man, but man as an extension of Earth." Striking vision, I find. Right? Looking back on the earth in the sense of the ability, he said, to cover it with his thumb, the site of all human history. And earth seeming fragile as a Christmas ornament, as it was drifting like a lost balloon on the black velvet of space. And then what arose from that? What was the insight that arose from that, right? He's saying that that image, it disarmed the illusions of individual or tribal isolation. Such a vision had this potential of tearing these astronauts out of, you could say, a self-centric view. This was a much larger view. And I want to point out, what we're doing here is similar in the sense of we're beginning to see clearly so that it tears us out of the way that we usually see the world. And a lot of this is because of the self-centric way that we see the world around us, or the self-centric way that we see experience. And later on in the retreat, we'll talk more and more about this creation of a self and actually dismantling it or breaking through it, because it's so important and so core for this flavor of freedom that the Buddha was speaking about. So what you're doing here really has that kind of profound nature that you might get a feel for in those descriptions. But I want to point out, it's probably not going to be that dramatic. This is not a dramatic process, and at the same time, it's a profound process. Paying attention, you might notice, to the feeling of the abdomen rising and falling is not that dramatic. But what I want to emphasize is that seeing that again and again clearly and feeling that clearly has a power to it that is just as profound of what the astronauts say. So, and I'd even say even more profound, because it has a way of really transforming our lives. And when we see the details of experience that we're going to be going over again and again, we're seeing the nature of reality. And then we can start to become more in harmony with the way things are. So let me give to move on now to give a description of seeing clearly more in terms of this practice. And again, it will be another metaphor, which I find really helpful. And this comes from Ajahn Chah. This is his description of what it is to see clearly when, for example, you'd be on retreat. And he gives an example of having a pet monkey. He says, for example, suppose at home you have a pet monkey. Monkeys don't stay still for long. They like to jump around and grab onto things. That's how monkeys are. Now you come to the retreat and you see the monkey here. This monkey doesn't stay still either. It jumps around just the same. But it doesn't bother you, does it? Why doesn't it bother you? Because you've raised a monkey before. You know what they're like. If you know just one monkey, no matter how many provinces you go to, no matter how many monkeys you see, you won't be bothered by them, will you? This is one who understands monkeys. If we understand monkeys, then we won't become a monkey. If you don't understand monkeys, you may become a monkey yourself. Do you understand? When you see it reaching for this and that, you shout, "Hey!" You get angry. "That damn monkey?" This is one who doesn't understand monkeys. One who knows monkeys sees that the monkey at home and the monkey in the retreat are just the same. Why should you get annoyed by them? When you see what monkeys are like, that's enough. You can be at peace. Have you seen the monkey yet? Has your mind gotten frustrated with the monkey? Yeah. This is what we do in our lives, right? We're fighting the monkey all the time. The thing is that it's just a monkey. And we could spend our lives hoping that the monkey will become some different kind of animal, but it's never going to happen. Monkeys are monkeys. And so what Ajahn Chah has pointed out is actually coming to terms with that's the nature of this animal. And again, this very important point is that when you understand the monkey, you don't become the monkey. This again is this going back to this sense of self. A lot of times we're creating some sense of self out of all these experiences that are arising. And it can be so. I want to give some examples of how this might happen on retreat and how this unfolds. I remember I was leading a retreat a while ago in Flagstaff, and somebody had come onto the retreat, and it was a shorter retreat, a weekend retreat, and they were feeling so tired, I think by the end of the first day. And there was this thought of like, damn it, I came on this retreat to really cultivate a presence of mind, and here I am just feeling tired all the time. What's up with this? This is a waste of my time. I live a busy life, I've set aside an entire weekend, and this is all that's going on, is tiredness. This is a horrible retreat, was her thought. I came here for something different. And then she realized, oh, this is just tiredness. This is just a state of mind. And she said, right then there was a turning. And there was a sense of relief that came simply by seeing that. What happened in that moment? It was a moment of seeing clearly, which is to see that that was simply a state of mind that was arising and passing away. She was able to see the monkey for what it was. And there was her freedom right there. Small taste of it. Of seeing clearly. And it came from simply noting. This is why I was emphasizing this practice of noting, of seeing that there, when there's a state of mind there, can you name it? Oh, tiredness. Oh, tiredness is just like this. Because what happens in that moment is that it's no longer me. It's a state of mind that's arising and passing away. And then there's a seeing clearly. It's seeing the way things are. When you see clearly, also the mind has a tendency to naturally let go, like hers did. It wasn't as entangled in it. So the emphasis is on this practice is not in terms of trying to let go. That's not what we're doing here. So I want to be clear about that. I have not given that instruction. The instruction I've given you is to see, to notice what's going on moment after moment. And through the noticing, the wisdom will arise that allows the mind to let go. Our job is just to notice. And then letting go will happen on its own, just like it did for this woman. Because when there's a seeing clearly, then of course we're not going to be entangled in what's going on. This is the kind of clear seeing that I'm talking about. And there are particular flavors of experience that the Buddha wanted us to see. And again, I'll refer back to this story. One is that experience is impermanent. That tiredness that she was experiencing actually was arising and passing away. Or it was increasing and decreasing. It was something that had a fluid manner to it. It also was, since it was arising and passing away, it was unreliable. It was something that was unsatisfactory. And most importantly for this story, it wasn't her. It wasn't, I am tired. It's tiredness is arising. So you might hear just in the story, getting a sense of these characteristics allowed her to have a different relationship to tiredness. And just as a side note, I want to point out, this is, I think, one way of understanding what the Buddha was trying to get to in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Right? Really explaining suffering, that's the issue that's here, getting to the nature of suffering or how suffering arises, the friction with it, which I'm going to call the grasping, the pushing away, the checking out. And the cure being, once there's the absence of the reactivity, there's a quality of freedom. And then explaining the Fourth Noble Truth, the way that unfolds. I want to share even a bit more now about how do we allow this seeing clearly to happen. And as I just mentioned, it's simply being present with your experience. Or in other words, it's this quality of mindfulness. The practice of mindfulness. And I want to be clear, just in terms of the kind of, you could say, the early Buddhism, the way I'm using mindfulness and the way I'm explaining it is I'm oversimplifying it. And I'm oversimplifying it on purpose. The reason I do that is because it makes it easier. And what I've noticed is when there's these two qualities that are emphasized, being aware and accepting what's going on, all the different conglomeration of mind states that the Buddha was encouraging us to cultivate can start to be nurtured through simply cultivating awareness and acceptance. So it's just, a more simplified version that allows what the Buddha was talking about to unfold. Because it's quite tricky when you look at, for example, the early discourses when the Buddha talks about mindfulness, for example, the four foundations of mindfulness. You might remember he refers to a conglomeration to a number of states of mind. For example, and she abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. We could spend some time talking about these terms of ardency and what full awareness is, and what it's meant by putting away covetousness and grief for the world. I prefer awareness and acceptance for the beginning of retreat. So I just wanted to say why this is. There's an evocative quality to this definition of mindfulness. How do we engage in being present? An image that some of you might be familiar with that I like to utilize is the image of a door person. That when you're on retreat, your job is very simple. You are the door person, let's say at some fancy hotel. And you only have one task, And that's to open the door for the guests that are coming in and going out. That's all you need to do. That's it. That's all that a door person does, right? Is you're there. And you have to see the guests. You have to notice the guests that are going in and out. So you do have to be awake, too. That's this door person is a wonderful way of understanding being aware and accepting. You're aware of the guests that come in and go, and you accept them. So this means that when there's a guest that comes that you don't particularly like maybe agitation or frustration or the mind being wandering all over the place, your job is not to try to shut the door. This is really important because you might have noticed that you've already tried to do that. And your job also is not to follow the guest into the hotel room. It's not like you open the door and you say, hey, let's go into the lobby and have a drink and hang out and talk about what we're going to do in the future. That's not the position of the door person. Have you noticed your mind do this? It's kind of you lost the position of the door person there. But your job is so much more simpler than that, and that's just to notice the guests that are coming in. Also, I want to point out that this metaphor is a little bit more complex than this. When you notice that you're not at the door anymore, what do? You simply notice that, right? So I find that I'm out in the bar having a drink, having a highball with the future thinker, getting drunk on future thoughts. Planning. That's all that's needed is simply noticing that, being the door person to that. And then immediately you're back at the door. So even with that, it's not like we're saying, I'm such a horrible door person, I can't do this, what am I doing on the streets? It's just the simple noticing of being okay with that. So sometimes just remembering that can be a helpful way of getting a feeling sense of this quality of mindfulness, of being mindful of what's going on. And as you notice with this, as I mentioned yesterday, this is not about figuring out what's going on or analyzing or thinking about what's going on. It's simply the simple bare attention, simply noticing what's arising and passing away. So it could be like feeling my abdomen rising and falling, feeling the warmth there, movement, tightness. Oh, it feels tight. It gets a little looser. And then there's thinking. The mind gets lost in thought. Oh, remembering, judging. There's a noticing of the quality of thought. And then coming back to the feeling of the abdomen rising and falling. Then there's a sound that pulls the mind away. Then I can label that hearing. And the way I'm using that label, I'm noticing what's going on. And then I spend a little bit of time with the hearing. And if it continues, then I come back to the breath. A sensation arises, right? An itch. Oh, itch. So I'm with that. I notice the vibratory quality of it, how it increases or decreases. It then dissipates. And then I come back to the feeling of the breathing. That way I'm noticing the fabric of experience. That simple noticing. I'm being the door person to whatever the experience is, whether it's a sensation, right? Tightness, looseness, movement, a thought, judging, remembering, fantasizing, planning, an emotion, joy, calmness, tranquility, anger, frustration, sleepiness, these qualities. And then there might be other sense gates, like hearing happens. So you hear, or a smell, noticing that. And then I was expanding it also to the times off the cushion, in the walking and the in-between times. And it can be a wonderful time, again, to use what I call a noting, which again, I want to say a few more things about. Like if I'm simply picking up this bell, and this can be a wonderful thing to do just to get mindfulness going during the in-between times, which is to note. And this is how I would note. So I want to be really clear how I would note it. Because a lot of times I'm noting the activity, So it could be different things. So it'd be reaching. So I'd make the mental label reaching. And what I do is I make the mental label. Oh, what's going on? Oh, reaching. And then there's a little while, maybe 4 or 5 seconds, when then I allow the awareness to soak into the experience of reaching. So it's like, oh, reaching. And then there's the important thing of the noticing and the feeling of it. Reaching. Seeing. So now there's the activity of seeing. I'm seeing the thing. So then I'm with the activity of seeing. For a little while. Grabbing. Then I'm with the feeling of grabbing. And then there's coolness. There's a sense of smoothness. And then you could say, flexing the limb. Flexing, just bringing it back. So do you see that there's these certain components of noting? There's the note, which is only 5% of your attention goes on to the noting. It's a very light mental label. 95% of my experience is the direct experience of what's going on. And I make the mental note, and then I have, you could say, 4 or 5 seconds of really soaking into the experience of noticing it. And then I move on to the next thing. You can do this in between times. That's the way that the noting would be utilized just when I'm sitting. Even if I'm labeling in and out or expanding, contracting, I'm labeling, making the note. I'm sorry, I should be really clear with my language. I'm labeling. I'll use this word labeling. I'm labeling what's going on, expanding, then I'm feeling it, and then I move on to the next label. So these labels, these mental labels, help with the noticing. And as I mentioned, there's a time to drop the labeling but continue with the noticing. The labeling is to help facilitate the noticing. When the mind's more concentrated and clear, there's less need for the noticing. Sometimes what I'll do is just during my daily, during the activities in between the sitting and walking, I'll continuously note for 5 or 10 minutes, and then I'll drop it. I'll continually label. I'm really doing a bad job of using the right terminology. I apologize, because I use these interchangeably. I'm trying to get a little more precise. I use the labels for 5 or 10 minutes, continuously labeling, and then I let go of it, and then just go into simply noticing, being aware. And you might notice that it brings a kind of a sharpness to the mindfulness. You can do the same thing with the sitting and the walking meditation. This is going to bring this other quality that's very important for the retreat that I briefly mentioned yesterday, which is right now in the retreat, now that we've started to get settled, is a quality of continuity. Mindfulness, no breaks from mindfulness. No, there's no breaks from this practice on this retreat. No break time. If you need to lie down and take a nap, that is so okay. You can take 5 naps a day. But to be mindful even during that. So no breaks doesn't mean you have to be on edge and tight. This means this relaxed, very easeful quality of being aware. The labeling can help with being the door person. It's kind of like you're saying, oh, there's the guest with the blue coat. There's the one with the red coat. There's the one with the high heels. There's the one with the flip-flops. All you need to do is notice. That's it. Very, very simple. And then there's the acceptance piece, which I want to name. This is very, very important. And this is a poem I often use. I come to see that this is just explains acceptance so well. So if you've heard it, I think it's wonderful to hear again. It's a poem by Alison Luderman. Again, the setting of the poem is imagining she's gone to swim her laps at a public swimming pool, and this is her experience when she gets there. She begins, "Try to love everything that gets in your way. The Chinese women in flowered bathing caps murmuring together in Mandarin, doing leg exercises in your lane, while you execute 36 furious laps, one for every item on your to-do list. The heavy-bellied man who goes thrashing through the water like a horse with a harpoon stuck in its side, whose breathless tsunamis rock you from your course. teachers all learn to be small and swim through obstacles like a minnow without grudges or memory. Dart toward your goal, sperm to egg. Thinking obstacle is another obstacle. Try to love the teenage girl idly lounging against the ladder, showing off her new tattoo. Cette vie est la mienne. This life is mine. In thick blue-black letters on her ivory instep. Be glad she'll have to look at it all her life and keep going. Keep going. Swim by an uncle in the lane next to yours who is teaching his nephew how to hold his breath underwater, even though kids aren't allowed at this hour. Someday, years from now, this boy who is kicking and flailing in the exact place you want to touch and turn will be a young man at a wedding on a boat, raising a champagne glass and a toast when a huge wave hits, washing everyone overboard. He'll come up coughing and spinning like he is now, but he'll come up like a cork, alive. So your moment of impatience must bow in service to a larger story, because if something is in your way, it is going your way, the way of all beings, towards darkness, towards light. Can you remember, as she says, if something is in your way, it is going your way? And that reminder, your moment of impatience must bow in service to a larger story. Everything that feels like it's getting in your way on this retreat is going your way. That is retreat, is starting to come to terms with the things that feel like are getting in your way. Or in other words, in Ajahn Chah's words, it's come to terms with the monkey. The monkey's not going to go away. You need to have a different relationship to it to see that you're actually both going the same way. So yesterday I spoke about being with the breath, and for some of you, the mind might have only been with the breath, maybe it felt like a couple minutes. That's retreat. And that's the importance of acceptance. To see that all these challenges is what deepens your practice. This is what practice is about. This is very important. As I mentioned yesterday about the woman who said, oh yeah, I don't need to remember to be aware, I just need to remember to accept. And that's the gateway into this quality of presence. I remember my first retreat I had done in, the first 10-day retreat that I did was in India. It was at Igat Puri, one of the main centers of Asan Goenka. And I was quite new to sitting, and it was incredibly painful. And I remember after the first full day, after the first Dharma talk that he gave, where he instructed that we had to stay there for the 10 days, I was thinking, I do not want to stay here for 10 days. This is like day one. I can't imagine making it to day 10, given how hard day one was. And I actually had no idea how I was going to make it through. It was really this sense of, yeah. Actually, I remember, this is just coming to mind, I remember talking to a guy before we started the retreat and kind of making a connection with him. And I don't know if you've ever noticed, sometimes on retreat, sometimes this is what I do, is that if I have some tenuous connection, even a tenuous connection with someone, just seeing them around kind of gives me a sense of buoyancy or allows me a kind of a tether to allow me to make it through. And he disappeared after the first day. Oh my God, I'm here all alone. So my tether was gone. And then it was so wonderful to see that really what it was just worry. And again, just realizing that, there was a sense of relief. Oh, okay, yeah, this is just what the mind's doing. This is what we're doing, just seeing what's going on. And what I like to emphasize is I do find it's very helpful to keep it simple. One other story that was quite helpful for me. Before I went to Burma the first time, I was a bit worried or concerned. I was going to study with teacher Saito Upandita, who was not known for his warmth towards yogis at times. So I wanted to prepare myself, and I asked a friend who had spent a number of years practicing over there. And I so appreciated his advice. He said, all you need to do is walk, then sit, then walk, then sit, then maybe eat, and then maybe you lie down to go to sleep, and then you get up and you walk, and you sit. It was so wonderful for him to just simplify it for me, that's all that was required of me, was just to simply engage in the practice. You might want to remember that, just to keep it that simple. And yes, it takes a lot of faith to have the faith of, wow, is this enough for transformation? And what I'm trying to emphasize is it is. Keep it simple, just noticing. And then why are we doing this? As I said, it's for freedom, this quality of freedom. How to understand that? I think for many of you who've been practicing, you know what the relief that can come when you continue to engage in this practice. And yet I want to give kind of two examples of this, or two feeling qualities, just to remind us. Again, as I mentioned yesterday, my main job is to simply remind you of things that you already have a sense of. One way I feel to get a sense of this freedom is just to imagine what it would be like to be completely okay with your experience moment after moment, that there's just this underlying okayness. The way the Buddha defined this is it's a mind that's free of greed, hatred, and delusion. Sometimes that definition, I don't get a feeling quality, but if I imagine what it's like, what it'd be like to live my life where there's just this deep okayness with whatever arises, just that, I can get a sense of relief just thinking about that. Like, oh, that would be so cool. This is the direction that this path is going in. Or this Taoist story, which I feel also gives this feeling quality, some of this feeling quality of this freedom. And it's a Taoist story about Confucius. And remember that often in Taoist stories, Confucius does not look so great. And not only that, it's a story about Confucius with him surrounded by all his students, so he even looks worse. So here Confucius is with all of his students, and they're at this huge river. There's the river, and then beyond them, the river drops off to this huge waterfall that goes down this waterfall and then continues to go. And as they're up above the waterfall there's a woman swimming in the river. And she's getting closer and closer and closer to the waterfall. And as they see her get closer to the waterfall, there's a quality of panic, of concern that starts to arise in Confucius and his students. And she goes over the waterfall. And he summons his students and says, quickly, go down and see if you can find her and make sure she's okay. I mean, this is supposedly hundreds of feet, the waterfall, to make sure she's okay, to see if you can find her. And so they take this trail, this circuitous trail, all the way down to the bottom of the waterfall. And by the time they get there, she's already out of the water, and she's kind of singing and brushing her hair and doing just fine. And all of them are in quite amazement. And Confucius finally gets down there and is very surprised and says, "I thought you were some kind of sprite, some kind of celestial being that could do that. But when I look closer, I see that you're just a human being. What's up with this? How'd you do that?" It was amazing. In particular, he says, "How did you tread water? How do you swim that makes this possible? You should be dead from such a thing." And she says, "I actually have no particular way of swimming. But I began to learn this art at the very earliest time. As I grew up, it became my nature to practice it. And my success in it is now as sure as fate. I enter and go down with the water in the very center of its whirl and come up again with it when it whirls the other way. I follow the way of the water and do nothing contrary to it of myself. This is how I tread it. This is how I swim." I follow the way of the water and do nothing contrary to it. When you start to get the feeling sense of the nature of this moment, that it's impermanent, the flowing quality of it, and since it's impermanent, it's unreliable. Why would you grasp onto something that's unreliable? You can't find reliability there. And that it's not you, there's a way of actually being able to swim with it, to swim with the unfolding of experience. That is freedom. When your mind sees impermanence again and again and again, the feeling of the abdomen rising and falling and rising and falling, a thought coming and going, the mind getting lost in thought and coming back, an emotion arising and passing away. It's like we get the feeling sense of what it is to swim with experience rather than fight it. So may our practice together lead to such freedom. Freedom for ourselves and freedom for all beings. So let's sit just for a minute here.